Welcome to the Harris Podcast. I'm Brianna.
I'm Vivi.
And I'm Addie. And on today's episode, we're going to be discussing farmworkers and the COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to be taking a deep dive into the history of farmworking, both in the U.S. and North Carolina. We're going to be looking at the various factors that impact farmworkers, such as being undocumented, housing, language barriers, and having limited access to healthcare. Then, we're going to hear from an amazing physician, Dr. Majali Moore, who is working to change the outlook of farmworkers, both within the pandemic and beyond.
So we wanted to start off the podcast today by giving a quick overview of the history of farmworking in the United States. Farmworking has a really long and controversial history in our country. Dating back to the 1800s, farmworking has often relied on immigrant labor. Farmworkers come from all over, from Mexico, China, Japan, the Philippines, and many other countries. Well, how did that come to be? So in the 19th century, farms were usually small and had limited number of workers. But as Americans began moving from rural to urban areas and industrialization took off in the late 19th century, smaller farms died out and were absorbed into these larger conglomerates. And at the same time, farming itself was becoming more advanced with new, faster technology. And so there was this chain reaction where new technology increased the cost of farming, which then increased the need for a migrant seasonal labor force. Then World War I started, which further increased the need for agricultural workers. So in 1917, Congress passed the Immigration and Nationality Act, which imported around 70,000 workers, more or less, from Mexico to the U.S. Also, again, we saw a similar pattern occur when World War II began. Agricultural demand rose again. Finally, Congress passed the Bracero Act in 1943. And the Bracero Act was basically an agreement between the U.S. and Mexican government to bring Mexican immigrants to the United States to work on farms. The program continued until 1964, ultimately bringing in more than 5 million Mexican farm workers. As the number of farm workers grew, there was increasing concern over the poor living conditions farm workers were subjected to. There were high levels of poverty, poor education, harsh working conditions, and violence. Workers could not organize or form unions to protect themselves. The exploitation of farm workers led to the publishing of an eye-opening documentary, Harvest of Shame, by journalist Edward R. Murrow. And this documentary was especially important because it exposed how bad conditions were for migrant farm workers. And once the public saw how bad things were, there was a bit of progress made. The National Farm Workers Association was established, and also the Migrant Health Act was passed in 1962. And the Migrant Health Act helped to expand services and clinics for farm workers across the country. And all of this sounds great, but still, here we are 60 years later, and farm workers are still negatively impacted by many social determinants of health.
And listener, if you haven't had a chance to watch The Harvest of Shame, it is definitely a watch. They did a really good job of traveling out to the farms and really exposed a lot of the conditions that farm workers were living in and showed things that America did not know about, such as treatment and the working conditions of farm workers. And it was super, super impactful because it was aired after Thanksgiving Day. So while people were sitting at their tables and eating leftovers and stuff, food that farm workers likely picked, they were exposed to like all of this information. And they did a follow-up documentary that was like something 50 years later. And what was impactful about that one is that they noticed that nothing had really changed within those 50 years, which I think speaks volumes to the lack of federal support that there is for farm workers. Some of the language and images are difficult to see and hear, so please proceed with caution.
And on the topic of, you know, housing, I can't bring up talk more about the housing options for farm workers, or better yet, the lack of adequate housing for farm workers. Farm workers have three options for housing. First being grow-owned or privately rented or government housing. By law, grows are required to provide housing to H-2A workers. However, H-2A workers only account for 10% of the nation's workforce. If you're not an H-2A worker and live in grow-owned housing, rent is deducted from your paycheck. Although grows are mandated to provide housing to H-2A workers, there are a few standards which are rarely enforced for the housing. Barriers to adequate housing include loose regulations. For example, the North Carolina Migrant Housing Act requires only one toilet for every 15 people and only one laundry tub for 30 people. And this is a laundry tub, not a laundry machine. Additionally, the low number of inspectors makes it easy for these minimal living standards to be enforced. Here's a quote from a study that highlights this issue. In the largest and most comprehensive study of farm worker housing conducted in the Southeast, researchers at Wake Forest School of Medicine found multiple violations of state and federal housing standards in every camp they studied. Farm workers also may fear reporting these poor living standards because they fear repercussions. And the second option is that farm workers may opt for privately rented housing in isolated rural areas with limited housing options. Their owners can have a monopoly on available housing, which allows them to overcharge for rent. The last option isn't really an option for most farm workers. In order to qualify for government housing, one must be documented. At least 6 out of 10 farm workers are undocumented. This kind of ties into your topic, Adi, of documentation status in farm worker communities.
Yeah, this is one of the topics I really wanted to focus in on because, as you mentioned, Mibi, the vast majority of farm workers are undocumented. But I kind of want to take a step back and see what access to healthcare looks like for undocumented peoples in general. Because they lack documentation, undocumented immigrants are ineligible for federal aid, and that includes Medicaid, Medicare, CHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program. And if you think of what that looks like, it basically means that federally they don't qualify for any type of health insurance and are ineligible for health insurance through the ACA, meaning they can't even buy insurance from the federal government at the marketplace. That leaves people with two options, which is purchase insurance privately, which can get really, really expensive, or getting insurance through your provider. If you don't have health insurance, this means that you're likely not receiving primary care, and one of the main points of access is going to be through the emergency room. There are others, which we'll talk about, but mainly emergency room. And in order to have that covered, you truly have to be in dire circumstances to qualify for something called emergency Medicaid. And that's when you're coming in to the emergency room and it's a life-saving procedure that you need, and that's when you would qualify, which is terrible. Undocumented immigrants also make up the largest group of uninsured individuals in the U.S., with an estimated between 45% to 71% of undocumented peoples lacking any type of healthcare coverage, and that number is going to change from state to state because certain states do open up a little bit more, such as California and New York, but mainly the way most undocumented immigrants are receiving primary care is through 1,400 federally qualified healthcare centers that were designated because the government understood that we can't let people fall through the cracks in healthcare. These primary care centers are dedicated to serving low-income and underserved areas and see unhoused and undocumented people as well. And what I found really interesting was some of the numbers behind Medicaid and specifically for undocumented peoples is in terms of expenditure. According to Medicaid data in 2016, the federal government spent $974 million in total emergency life-saving services for undocumented immigrants, but that only represents 0.2% of all Medicaid expenditure. Overall, within that same year, the government spent on Medicaid $565 billion. And what's crazy to me, which I hate making things about the numbers, like I really truly do, but when we're talking about generating wealth and income taxes, in 2018, undocumented immigrants contributed $20.1 billion in federal taxes and $11.8 billion in state and income taxes. Further, between 2000 and 2011, undocumented immigrants generated $35.1 billion in surplus for the Medicaid trust fund. So why did I bring all these numbers up? Basically, it means that undocumented immigrants are funding and paying for these programs that they do not have access to, which to me is incredibly heartbreaking. And what I also find really important is I think something we have to share and talk about is that 73% of farm workers are coming from outside of the US and about 50% of them are going to be undocumented. Having these issues and barring them from access to healthcare specifically based on status is going to be one of the huge impediments to having an overall well health. Being undocumented is therefore one of the social determinants of health and one of those barriers to accessing health. H2A itself, like we talked about earlier, it doesn't provide any type of status. It's only temporary. It's one of those things where you can keep reapplying for, but it doesn't grant you any protection. It's not giving you a pathway to citizenship. It doesn't protect you from low wages. It doesn't protect you from being taken advantage of. It doesn't protect you from overcrowding and unsafe housing. It doesn't protect you from lack of health care. And it's truly one of those things where you're still suffering from anxiety because you can still get arrested and you can still get deported. So it's just adding another layer to chronic health outcomes. And the second thing I want to highlight was language barriers. I think It goes without saying that if you do not speak the language of your patients, as a provider, you are not able to provide adequate care. Under Title IV of the Civil Rights Act, federally funded institutions must provide an interpreter for patients. This is not always enforced, and sometimes funding is simply not enough for these centers. But as we've seen, I know, in our studies and personal experiences, when patients do not have an interpreter, they're less satisfied with their care, they're more likely to not follow up with their provider or not have a great relationship with their provider. A 2000 literature review for the Journal of Midwifery Women's Health confirmed all of this and also found that miscommunication can subject patients to really expensive tests and unnecessary procedures. Language, therefore, serves as another barrier for farm workers, specifically because, as we've seen, most are traveling from outside of the U.S. That's why it's so important that providers such as Dr. Moore, who we're going to hear from a little bit later, it's so important that they continue to work and increase bilingual care and make healthcare specifically for farm workers more accessible.
And now that we have provided some information about farm workers and the various barriers they face, we want to introduce to our listeners a doctor that worked closely with farm workers throughout the pandemic, Dr. Modjali Moore. Dr. Moore graduated from Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine in 2011. She completed her family medicine residency at Greater Lawrence Family Health Center and began her medical career in rural eastern North Carolina at a community health center. This experience, combined with her interest in immigrant health, led her to become the medical director for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Farm Worker Health Program. And now, let's chat with Dr. Moore.
So to start, can you just tell us a little bit more about how you got involved with farm workers, or also maybe more about your background?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Dr. Modjali Moore, and I'm in the Family Medicine Department, and I am so happy to spend time with you because we work together in the field too. And so my history with caring for farm workers started in North Carolina, and a little bit before that as well in Massachusetts, but really significantly in the northeastern part of the state. I went from medical training right into a federally qualified health center who received federal migrant dollars to take care of migrant and seasonal farm workers. And so was basically a doctor on call and felt like I could reach out to this community because I can communicate in Spanish. So that was helpful, making sure that people feel well heard and like kind of putting that language justice like to the top of the list, making sure that healthcare is excellent quality from the start of the entry to the door to the care plan. And so Northeast North Carolina is in, and all throughout the Northeast is in a really big high volume center for our migrant workers who are usually H-2A visa workers. And I think we've all on this kind of conversation interacted with them as well. And they're coming in through Mexico, usually March through April, and then they're leaving actually now because we have lots of departures going on right now. So that northeastern part of the state sees a lot of those, a lot of need for care. And as we all know, it's hard for farm workers to access care because they're working until like six or seven at night and clinics close at 5. And so the system as we know it doesn't help that much in terms of like providing space to have health needs addressed. And so I found that rewarding as kind of a early practitioner on my new license after residency to really try and say like, how do you extend the care to the communities? And so a lot of that had to do with like going out to the camps with a mobile clinic or actually bringing people in when they needed us and not being incredibly strict with like, oh, I'm already booked, I don't have room, and realizing how difficult it is to actually bring a farm worker into a clinic. Because a lot of times that means you are out of work, you're not getting paid, and you have a health concern that is impairing your ability to do your work, which is like your first priority. And so that was kind of my initial experience. And so had a really positive, time with that. And then also bridged into seasonal family relationships where we were seeing people over time and caring for kids and realizing that this really helps us to step back and think about social determinants of health for our agricultural workers and how so much more complex that is. And one of the things the state program does is we really think about digital inclusion, because in it, and this is perfect, like we're on Zoom right now, like being able to be on Zoom is such, we're so grateful for that, because we have internet, we have computers, we know how to log on, we have a Zoom account. When we think about farm workers, it's like you all have seen, we have to bring the hotspots, we have to bring everything, and make sure everybody is like having that same access. So I think I got off topic, but that, or I went in a different direction, but I think, yeah, I'm just like so energized by delivering care outside of our traditional models. And that really allows us to take care of our most vulnerable populations. And unfortunately we have those, we have significant amount, the tally or the kind of population of farm workers in the state this year, I think was 72,000.
Wow.
The state program only touches about 11,000. So we have so much work, and there is a huge volumes in the northeast of the state. We've got the mountains, it's Christmas tree time. So everybody's actually kind of transferring over to the mountains now. So really interesting, like interactions for us as healthcare providers to really try and figure out like how to meet the needs of those essential workers.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. I guess my question is, why do you think we only reach like 1/7 of all farm workers?
Yeah, awesome question. So I think if we have, so we get a HRSA grant through the state, and that's been in existence since the early 90s, which is really exciting that the state had prioritized that. I mean, it makes total sense, because the economy coming in through agriculture for North Carolina is incredibly significant. Those numbers just keep climbing. The thing about it is that is only a small amount of funding. And so like the state program only funds 8 centers around the state, which is great. I mean, we're so grateful we have that, but I think we need even more expanded infrastructure. And so we are trying, and I think actually let's bring it to COVID, which is like really relevant to this conversation, but COVID has allowed us to connect even more. So previously we were probably seeing maybe like 9,000 people. We've expanded that significantly amongst those 8 sites, even through the pandemic, which you would think people were more out of care, but actually just because of how amazing the outreach teams are, and that's how the state program functions. It's a very much a public health system of community health workers. That model had allowed us to reach farm workers better and actually try to increase numbers. So I think, you know, it takes a while. If you look at federally qualified health centers, the requirement is you need to be accessing more patients, and you need to increase your growth, you need to grow your population of patients. And we're doing that, but it takes time and it takes money, unfortunately. So.
And I know you touched on a little bit about this earlier when you were talking about like language barriers and kind of the social determinants of health. What in your experience have been the biggest barriers to healthcare for farm workers? And kind of like second to that, like how has COVID-19 really kind of blown those up or really just changed the way they look?
Yeah. So barriers, definitely language tends to be a problem in rural North Carolina, because we are lucky to be in a place where there are more bilingual speakers. And that's in more like kind of urban metropolitan centers. In the rural areas, you tend to have communities of like seasonal families who will kind of stay together. But when they interact with the health system, a lot of times they'll bring like health advocates with them. Maybe one of the 10 people that goes in is maybe fluent in both languages, but the majority of people are Spanish speaking only, which makes sense, especially if you're kind of coming back and forth. And it tends to be in our hospital systems and in our rural clinics, we don't have that great of language support. There's interpreters, there's like video interpreter kind of services, but as we all know, that falls short. I think an in-person interpreter is like much better to really help connect. So that's a big barrier. The other barrier is access, like we were talking about. So farm workers can't come in from 8 to 5. As neither can doctors, like everybody's working. So like, I think, you know, or just like all of our working population. So just in terms of like how the clinic hours are set up, that's a huge barrier. So we talk a lot about access with the state program. And so a lot of the clinics that serve farm worker populations are going to be clinics that have extended hours. So like Johnston County with Dr. Maynard and the Benson Area Medical Center, they have their Thursday night, and we try to do the mobile clinic on Tuesday nights. And we see in our mountain sites at Vecinos, they have like definitely mobile clinics in the evenings, and then they go and they have a freestanding clinic access at advanced access hours. And so that is a barrier. And I think the program tries to attend to that because we know we need to see people when they're available. The other thing is probably if we're thinking about just health literacy, and I think sometimes when we think about that, we think about like, oh, you don't maybe have educational level to understand health. But I think there's so many dynamics because we have amazing experience in our farm worker population. Like we have people who are coming with graduate degrees. We have people who are professional athletes. Like we have a lot of really skilled workers who are also amazingly skilled in agriculture. And we have so much to learn from them as well. But when I think about health literacy with farm workers, I think more about system navigation. Because like if we were going to work in agriculture in Mexico, it would be a totally different system. And it's like, you rely on people to help you navigate that. And so there's barriers because I think sometimes we skip those steps. And so that tends to be really difficult. And so that we saw very, very, very kind of like prominently with COVID, because COVID was like, okay, vaccines, and you might need to seek healthcare. And it's like, you become dependent on the system. And so that was like a very big challenge. And one of the things that was really exciting is we were able to build local teams. So the local teams that were built in 100 counties in North Carolina, which is just amazing that this happened. But in 100 counties, we had the health department have like a representative or like an advocate. We had the ag extension agent. So in each county, there's actually an agricultural like support person. So that person was part of the team. We invited any other health entity that would be helpful. So maybe like a health center, or maybe like anybody who is kind of navigating COVID. And we're able to bring those people together. And then some of the high volume counties like Wake County or Lenoir County, the local teams were just like fantastic. Communication was improved. Access to farm workers were improved in Sampson County. I just like love looking at this data, but the uptake of vaccines in farm workers was significantly higher because of these like approaches than the actual county itself. So like when you look at like who's vaccinated, like the farm workers were like all vaccinated. I think it was like over like 85% of farm workers. It was awesome. And that response, actually the whole farm worker team COVID response received the governor's award for that just a few weeks ago because of how well they could get like basically overcome challenges that were incredibly significant. So
I feel like I could go on for. No, that's incredible. Because I think when we were kind of looking up a little bit more on the topic and just kind of discussing what healthcare access looks like for farm workers, I think the COVID pandemic kind of really posed a great either threat or a great opportunity for growth. And it's so amazing to hear that it's been going really well in terms of increasing access.
So you've dedicated. You've dedicated so much of your practice to working with farm workers, which is amazing. What changes do you hope to see with the farm working community as far as healthcare access goes?
Yeah, so this is a big conversation with the state program, which runs through the Office of Rural Health and Department of Health and Human Services. But we're trying to come up with our strategic priorities because we have been in emergency response so greatly for the last 3 years. So I think what we would love to see, especially from a clinical priority perspective, is like COVID integrated into chronic care management and really helping our farm workers to identify health risk. So, you know, like almost doing more panel management around our population. So we're identifying our patients with diabetics and our patients who have high blood pressure and people who fall into risk. And then really trying to reach out for support in that respect. And that's a different level as opposed to just like kind of like vaccinate everyone. That's kind of your first level. And now we're really getting into more complex care because we do have people with pretty significant health risk. And we want to make sure that we are identifying that and responding to that and just supporting them through that. So that's kind of like a big topic. The other thing that is a high priority is the pandemic has opened virtual care to all of us. Now you go into your doctor and it's like, do you want an in-person? Do you want a virtual? Do you want a phone? Like, it's a menu of what do you want for your care? And so we're really hoping to expand telehealth because that allows different access to specialty care and to other services that might not have been in the rural areas. And that I'm kind of thinking of the program ECHO, which I don't know if you've heard of, but the ECHO program was started with liver treatment in New Mexico. It's an amazing program. It like basically connects your specialist. So you have your hepatologist, for example, and then you're the provider in a rural area, but your patient has hepatitis C, but you need a little bit more support. So I think I was just looking at their motto is like deliver knowledge, I think it's move knowledge, don't move the people. And so it's like community-based care. And I think with COVID, we can really just like take this model to the next level and really attend to some of the risks that we see in our farm workers and their health priorities too.
That sounds incredible. I think that I feel like we had a lot of conversations. I think my follow-up question to that, I think we talked about earlier how when we go to rural clinics, some internet and thing access like that can be really difficult. What would kind of be that next step to increase that connection? Because I think that's something that's really important and vital to like telehealth.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Because without the internet, you don't have telehealth. Exactly. So that is digital equity and inclusion. And for farm workers, it's so important. It also like just fundamentally, like farm workers are away, like the H2A kind of migrant worker is away from family, away from children or sick people or sick loved ones and things like that. And even just having cell phone access to like get on WhatsApp and like communicate with family like improves emotional health. And so like the digital kind of inclusion and equity part has just like really come to the forefront in the state also, and actually nationally, because even the federal government has prioritized money for rural areas to try and really improve broadband infrastructure. So what the big ask from all agricultural communities, because it really is across the table, it's farm workers, it's farmers, it's everybody in the rural area. Like if we could have broadband throughout the state, we could enhance quite a bit and probably also enhance the economy and the educational experiences for our kids. And like, I think that it's a big level move. But in the meantime, we're going to continue. We have a digital alliance that focuses on agricultural workers, and that runs through NC State and ECU. It's like multi-center collaborative, and they do amazing work to try and like make sure information is accessible, and we bring hotspots out, and you know, not just for health delivery, but for any kind of social determinant of health like need. And there's trainings, there's like digital literacy trainings and things like that. So that's something that I think us in our careers will just continue to hear. Because if you implement something like even the UNC MyChart and you don't have a smartphone or you don't have minutes on your smartphone and you don't know how to, you know, like connect the app or you don't have internet, you know, I mean, it's just like it's wonderful for us to take those steps backwards and be like, wait a second, we have to think about like the ground up and we can't just like skip to, oh yeah, just go on my chart, you know, kind of thing. So it's an exciting topic. And I think it's something we all can have a voice and we can bring farm workers' voices and we can leverage that and we can really try to move towards that.
No, that's amazing. And I think what I really liked about the course that we took this semester was it was highlighting these things, right? Like, how can we highlight and find these social determinants of health or these gaps in care? And how do we like change that? Because essentially what we want to do in future positions is increase access and make sure that people are getting as much care as possible when they need it and before they really need it, right? And so it's really incredible to hear all the work that y'all have been doing. And so it's really awesome. The last question I think we have for you is there anything in general in terms of healthcare and working with farm workers that you would like to highlight or you would like people to know about your practice?
Yeah, I think that I want to thank everyone who has come out to the mobile clinic. I also am just appreciative that it is such a team effort because it really does take like a team to provide advanced access care, which means like going into a camp or bringing the mobile bus or wherever we're doing. And so that I think is really important to acknowledge, that it's just really great to be surrounded by people who prioritize that. And then the other thing is, like, I really think, especially in medical training, we really need to push ourselves to grow in terms of being flexible, because as you know, when we're out in the camps, like, you got to make it work. So your priority is keeping the farm worker healthy and, like, trying to get to this best, like, wellness and well-being. But the process is very humbling, because, like, you've got to navigate, like, all these different things, whether it's, like, the environment where the clinic is built or, like, put up, how are you going to get the medications, what language you're going to communicate in. Like, I just feel like that flexibility is so, it's so rewarding to practice that way and to always be thinking, like, how can I maximize someone's health by myself stepping out of my comfort zones sometimes. And I think that is important, and I think it's such a great message for us as we're always lifelong learners of how to deliver care. So that should be that's a good one.
That was the incredible Dr. Moore. We all had the opportunity to work with her and the rest of the farm worker healthcare team through the mobile clinic, where we travel out to the farms and see farm workers until about 10 or 11 at night. It was so amazing to see all the ways that they are working to increase access for farm workers, specifically on how the COVID-19 pandemic allowed them to increase in broadband infrastructure. That is a total game changer. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we hope you were able to take in some of the history of farm working and note the various factors that impact farm workers, such as being undocumented, housing, language barriers, and having a limited access to healthcare. I'm Addie.
I'm Brianna.
I'm Vivi.
And this is the Harris Podcast. Join us next time.